Macmillan Audio presents Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America by Thomas L. Friedman. Read for you by Oliver Wyman. Part 1. Where We Are. Chapter 1. Where Birds Don't Fly. German engineering, Swiss innovation, American nothing. Advertising slogan used on a billboard in South Africa by Daimler to promote its smart 4-4 compact car. In June 2004, I was visiting London with my daughter Orly, and one evening we went to see the play Billy Elliot at a theater near Victoria Station. During intermission, I was standing up, stretching my legs in the aisle next to my seat, when a stranger approached and asked me, "Are you Mr. Friedman?" When I nodded yes, he introduced himself. "My name is Imad Tinawi. I am a Syrian-American working for Booz Allen, the consulting firm." Tinawi said that while he disagreed with some of the columns I had written, particularly on the Middle East, there was one column he especially liked and still kept. "Which one?" I asked with great curiosity. "The one called Where Birds Don't Fly," he said. For a moment, I was stumped. I remembered writing that headline, but I couldn't remember the column or the dateline. Then he reminded me. It was about the new, post-9/11, U.S. consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. For years, the U.S. consulate in Istanbul was headquartered in the Palazzo Corpi, a grand and distinctive old building in the heart of the city's bustling business district, jammed between the bazaars, the domed mosques, and the jumble of Ottoman and modern architecture. Built in 1882 and bought by the U.S. government 25 years later, Palazzo Corpi was bordered on three sides by narrow streets and was thoroughly woven into the fabric of Istanbul life. It was an easy place for Turks to get a visa, to peruse the library, or to engage with an American diplomat. But as part of the general security upgrade for U.S. embassies and consulates in the post-9/11 world, it was decided to close the consulate at Palazzo Corpi, and in June 2003, a new U.S. consulate was opened in Istinye, an outlying district about 12 miles away from the center of the city. The new 22-acre facility, nearly 15 times as big as the old consulate, was built on a solid rock hill, a Federal Times article reported April 25, 2005, adding that state now requires buildings to have protective walls that are at least 100 feet away from embassies and consulates. Those walls and barriers also must protect against explosions and ramming attacks from vehicles, and they must be difficult to climb. Guard booths are placed at the perimeter of facilities, and windows and doors are bulletproof and resist forced entries. The new buildings are also strong enough to resist most earthquakes and bombs. They are also strong enough to deter most visitors, friends, and allies. In fact, when I first set eyes on the new consulate in 2005, what struck me most was how much it looked like a maximum security prison, without the charm. All that was missing was a moat filled with alligators and a sign that said in big red letters, "Attention, you are now approaching the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. Any sudden movements and you will be shot without warning. All visitors welcome." They could have filmed the Turkish prison movie Midnight Express there. But here's a hard truth. Some U.S. diplomats are probably alive today thanks to this fortress. Because on November 20th, 2003, as President George W. Bush was in London meeting with then-Prime Minister Tony Blair, and about 6 months after the new U.S. consulate in Istanbul had been opened, Turkish Muslim terrorists detonated truck bombs at the HSBC Bank and the British consulate in Istanbul, killing 30 people, including Britain's consul general, and wounding at least 400 others. The bomb-ravaged British mission was just a short walk from the Palazzo Corpi. One of the terrorists captured after the attack reportedly told Turkish police that his group had wanted to blow up the new U.S. consulate, but when they checked out the facility in İstinye, they found it impregnable. A senior U.S. diplomat in Istanbul told me more of the story. According to Turkish security officials, the terrorists said the new U.S. consulate was so secure, they don't let birds fly there. I never forgot that image. It was so well guarded, they don't even let birds fly there. That point was reinforced on July 9, 2008, when Turkish police outside the consulate killed three terrorists apparently trying to breach its walls. Tinawi and I swapped impressions about the corrosive impact such security restrictions were having on foreigners' perceptions of America and on America's perceptions of itself. As an Arab American, he was clearly bothered by this, and he could tell from my column that I was too. Because a place where birds don't fly is a place where people don't mix, ideas don't get sparked, friendships don't get forged, stereotypes don't get broken, collaboration doesn't happen, trust doesn't get built, and freedom doesn't ring. That is not the kind of place we want America to be. That is not the kind of place we can afford America to be. An America living in a defensive crouch cannot fully tap the vast rivers of idealism, innovation, volunteerism, and philanthropy that still flow through our nation. And it cannot play the vital role it has long played for the rest of the world, as a beacon of hope and the country that can always be counted on to lead the world in response to whatever is the most important challenge of the day. We need that America, and we need to be that America more than ever today. This is an audio program about why. The core argument is very simple. America has a problem, and the world has a problem. America's problem is that it has lost its way in recent years, partly because of 9/11 and partly because of the bad habits that we have let build up over the last three decades, bad habits that have weakened our society's ability and willingness to take on big challenges. The world also has a problem. It is getting hot, flat, and crowded. That is, global warming, the stunning rise of middle classes all over the world, and rapid population growth have converged in a way that could make our planet dangerously unstable. In particular, the convergence of hot, flat, and crowded is tightening energy supplies, intensifying the extinction of plants and animals, deepening energy poverty, strengthening petro-dictatorship, and accelerating climate change. How we address these interwoven global trends will determine a lot about the quality of life on Earth in the 21st century. I am convinced that the best way for America to solve its big problem, the best way for America to get its groove back, is for us to take the lead in solving the world's big problem. In a world that is getting hot, flat, and crowded, the task of creating the tools, systems, energy sources, and ethics that will allow the planet to grow in cleaner, more sustainable ways is going to be the biggest challenge of our lifetime. But this challenge is actually an opportunity for America. If we take it on, it will revive America at home, reconnect America abroad, and retool America for tomorrow. America is always at its most powerful and most influential when it is combining innovation and inspiration, wealth building and dignity building, the quest for big profits, and the tackling of big problems. When we do just one, we are less than the sum of our parts. When we do both, we are greater than the sum of our parts, much greater. But it's not just an opportunity either. It's also a test. It's a test of whether we are able and willing to lead, whether you love us or hate us, whether you believe in American power or you don't. The convergence of hot, flat, and crowded has created a challenge so daunting that it is impossible to imagine a meaningful solution without America really stepping up. We are either going to be losers or heroes. There's no room anymore for anything in between, says Rob Watson, CEO of Ecotech International and one of the best environmental minds in America. Yes, either we are going to rise to the level of innovation, leadership, and collaboration that is required, or everybody is going to lose, in a big way. Just coasting along and kind of, sort of, doing the right things when they are convenient and easy, and letting the other stuff slip, that is not an option any longer. We need a whole new approach. As they say in Texas, if all you ever do is all you've ever done, then all you'll ever get is all you ever got. The simple name for the project I am proposing is Code Green. What red was to America in the 1950s and 1960s, a symbol of the overarching communist threat, the symbol that was used to mobilize our country to build up its military, its industrial base, its highways, its railroads, ports and airports, its educational institutions, and its scientific capabilities to lead the world in defense of freedom, we need green to be for today's America. Unfortunately, after 9/11, instead of replacing red with green, President George W. Bush replaced red with code red and all the other crazy colors of the Department of Homeland Security's warning system. It's time to scrap them all and move to code green. Of course, I am not calling for a return to anti-communist witch hunts and McCarthyism, just to the seriousness and determination to build a society that can face the overarching threat of our day. For me, going code green means making America the world's leader in innovating clean power and energy efficiency systems and inspiring an ethic of conservation toward the natural world, which is increasingly imperiled. We're going to need both massive breakthroughs in clean power and a deeper respect for the world's forests, oceans, and biodiversity hotspots if we're going to thrive in this new age. The first half of this program is a diagnosis of the unique energy, climate, and biodiversity challenges the world faces. The second half is an argument about how we can meet those challenges. I would be less than truthful, though, if I said I think America, as it operates today, is ready for this mission. We are not. Right now, we don't have the focus and persistence to take on something really big, where the benefits play out over the long term. But I believe that all could change with the right leadership, local, state, and federal, properly framing how much we have to gain by rising to this moment and how much we have to lose by failing to do so. Americans intuit that we're on the wrong track and that we need a course correction, and fast. Indeed, when I think of our situation, I am reminded of the movie The Leopard, based on the novel of the same name by Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa. It is set in 19th century Italy, at a time of enormous social, political, and economic turmoil. The main character is the Sicilian prince Don Fabrizio of Salina, played by Burt Lancaster. Don Fabrizio understands that he and his family will have to adapt if they want the House of Salina to retain its leadership in a new era, where social forces from below are challenging the traditional power elites. Nevertheless, Prince Salina is bitter and uncompromising. We were the leopards, the lions. Those who take our place will be jackals and sheep. The wisest advice he gets comes from his nephew Tancredi, played by Alain Delon, who marries a wealthy shopkeeper's daughter from the new moneyed middle class, and along the way cautions his uncle, "If we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change." And so it is with America. The era we are entering will be one of enormous social, political, and economic change, driven in large part from above, from the sky, from Mother Nature. If we want things to stay as they are, That is, if we want to maintain our technological, economic, and moral leadership and a habitable planet rich with flora and fauna, leopards and lions, and human communities that can grow in a sustainable way, things will have to change around here, and fast. When I look at America today, I see three broad trends, two of which are really troubling, and one which gives me hope that with different leadership, Americans would indeed step up to meet this challenge. I have already mentioned one disturbing trend. Post 9/11, we as a nation have put up more walls than ever, and in the process, we have disconnected ourselves emotionally, if not physically, from many of our natural allies and our natural instincts to embrace the world. In the process, America has shifted from a country that has always exported its hopes, and so imported the hopes of millions of others, to one that is seen as exporting its fears. The other disturbing trend has been building slowly since the 1980s. It is a dumb-as-we-wanna-be mood that has overtaken our political elite, a mood that says we can indulge in petty red-state-blue-state catfights for as long as we want and can postpone shoring up our healthcare system and our crumbling infrastructure, postpone addressing immigration reform, postpone fixing Social Security and Medicare, and postpone dealing comprehensively with our energy excesses and insecurity indefinitely. The prevailing attitude on so many key issues in Washington today is, we'll get to it when we feel like getting to it, and it will never catch up to us because we're America. In some ways, the subprime mortgage mess and housing crisis are metaphors for what has come over America in recent years. A certain connection between hard work, achievement, and accountability has been broken. We've become a subprime nation that thinks it can just borrow its way to prosperity, putting nothing down and making no payments for 2 years. Subprime lenders told us that we could have the American dream, a home of our own, without the discipline or sacrifice that home ownership requires. We didn't need to study hard and build a solid educational foundation. We didn't need to save and build a solid credit record. The bank around the corner or online would borrow the money from China and lend it to us, with a credit check no more intrusive than the check you get at the airport when they make sure the name on your airline ticket matches the one on your driver's license. When the whole pyramid scheme, operated by some of our best financial institutions, collapsed, everyone from simple homeowners to unscrupulous lenders looked to the government for a bailout. The politicians accommodated them, even though everyone knew that the lenders had not been betting that their customers' penchant for hard work or frugality or innovation would enable them to make the payments. They were simply betting that the housing bubble would keep driving up the prices of homes and that the mortgage rates would keep falling, that the market would bail everybody out forever. It did, until it didn't. As with our houses, so with our country. We have been mortgaging our future rather than investing in it. During the 2008 presidential primary campaign, Senators John McCain and Hillary Clinton both actually proposed suspending the federal excise tax on gasoline, 18.4 cents a gallon, for the summer's travel season, to give American drivers a break, even though they knew, because every expert in the country said so, that it would only increase demand for summer driving and therefore keep gasoline prices high and further contribute to the global warming that both senators claim to have plans to mitigate. That proposal was the epitome of dumb-as-we-wanna-be politics. There is a third trend, though, and this is the one that gives me hope. This is the trend toward what I call nation-building at home. While Washington may be gridlocked and drifting sideways, and our economic management has been anything but responsible, our country is still exploding with innovators, and idealists. Every week, I hear from people with their new ideas for making clean energy, or with new approaches to education, or with new thoughts about how to repair something in our country that desperately needs repairing. And though some of these ideas are wacky, the number of people experimenting in their garages and local communities certainly tells me that this country is still bursting with vitality from below. Our young people are so much more idealistic than we deserve them to be, and our broader public, though beaten down at times, is still eager to be enlisted. Enlisted to fix education, enlisted to research renewable energy, enlisted to repair our infrastructure, enlisted to help others. You can see it in the number of college graduates lining up to join Teach for America. They want our country to matter again. They want to be summoned, not just to do nation-building in Iraq or Afghanistan, but to do nation-building in America, to restore and revitalize something they cherish but feel is being degraded. Let's look more closely at each of these trends. When she was in eighth grade, my younger daughter, Natalie, participated in the National History Day program. The focus that year was turning points in history, and school children across the land were invited to submit research projects that illuminated any such turning point. Natalie's project, which was co-winner for the state of Maryland, was How Sputnik Led to the Internet. It traced how the United States reacted to the Soviet launch of Sputnik by better networking our scientific research centers and how those early crude networks proliferated and eventually were woven into the Internet. But the subtext was that our reaction to one turning point in history unintentionally triggered another turning point decades later in a way no one could have predicted. I worry that 50 years from now, some eighth grader will be doing her National History Day project on how America's reaction to 9/11 unintentionally disconnected us from parts of the world, from our best friends, and from elements of our own identity. The well-known Indian author Gurcharan Das remarked to me during a visit to Delhi in 2005 that on several post-9/11 trips to America, he had been forced by border control agents to explain why he was visiting. "They make you feel so unwanted now," said Das. "America was a country that was always reinventing itself," he added, "because it was a country that always welcomed all kinds of oddballs and had this wonderful spirit of openness. American openness has always been an inspiration for the whole world," he told me. "If you go dark, the world goes dark." We have not gone dark yet, but since 9/11, we have been afraid, and when you are afraid, you're not yourself. In December 2007, I was visiting Bahrain to interview the country's crown prince, Sheikh Salman bin Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, whom I have known and liked for many years. We were at a bistro having pizza, and at the table next to us were a Bahraini mother, father, and daughter. The mother was wearing a headscarf and was dressed all in black with utmost modesty. The daughter was dressed like an American teenager and had what looked like a tattoo on her left shoulder. Crown Prince Salman and I started talking about her generation of Bahrainis who have come of age since 9/11. In 2004, he reminded me, after an attack on a U.S. base in Saudi Arabia and some terrorist threats in Bahrain, the Pentagon ordered all U.S. dependents from its Fifth Fleet naval facility in Bahrain to return home to America. This threatened the collapse of the sole American-style high school in Bahrain, the Bahrain School, which had been set up in 1968 by the U.S. Department of Defense to cater to Navy dependents, and had been the quality educational landmark in the country ever since. By the 1980s, American military dependents made up only 30% of the school's population, while nearly 70% were tuition-paying non-Americans, primarily the sons and daughters of Bahrain's business and political elite, including the crown prince in his day. The closure of the school and the departure of the dependents would have brought to an end everything from the American Women's Annual Flower Show in Bahrain to American Bahraini softball games to young Americans competing in soccer leagues with young Bahrainis. The Bahraini leadership, many of whom graduated from the school and were introduced to the American way of life there, pleaded with the Pentagon to keep its dependents in Bahrain and keep its education beachhead open. But the dependents left, and the school managed to survive only after the Bahraini government agreed to write checks to the Pentagon. "That school was a real meritocracy," said my Bahraini friend Sareen Al-Shirawi, who graduated from there in 1987 and is now a business consultant in London. "Once you walked into that school, who you were did not matter. You were always judged on merit, which was very different from other schools in Bahrain, where you were judged on your wealth or family connections. Until today, the people in Bahrain who graduated from that school are different. You got discipline. You were encouraged to take risks and fail. It was run according to the American value system." Added Crown Prince Salman, "The American school was the best advertisement the Americans ever had. It made more friends than the American embassy. Sad to say, now there is a young generation of Bahrainis growing up who never got introduced to that America. If they are 17 years old today, they were 11 when September 11th happened. They never saw the fall of the Berlin Wall. They never saw America's liberation of Kuwait. They only know the America of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. It is not the America we fell in love with," said Salman, although he hastened to add, "I am sure that America will come back." "I am sure that it can come back, but not if we remain on the track that we've been on. I was visiting The Hague in January 2008, and my Dutch friends Volkert and Karen Doeksen told me a story that made me laugh and cry at the same time. In April 2004, they said, they had been invited to a dinner party at a restaurant in The Hague, Impero Romano, by the U.S. ambassador to Holland at the time. The dinner was for the visiting head of the United States Drug Enforcement Administration, Karen Tandy, as well as for then Dutch Minister of Health, Welfare and Sport, Hans Hoogervorst. I arrived to the dinner a little late, and the restaurant looked full," recalled Volkert, who is the CEO of a Dutch investment fund. "Only when we all got up to leave at the end of dinner did I realize how many guards the Americans had." "Why?" I asked. "Because between Tandy's own security guards and those of the U.S. ambassador and those added by the Dutch government, it was like the whole restaurant got up to leave with us. There was almost nobody left," Volkert explained. "The best part was that our Minister of Health, who was the only person anyone would have recognized, had no security guards. He arrived at the restaurant on his bicycle." After dinner, Volkert said, "Our whole group went out for a walk around the central square. It was the eve of a Dutch national holiday, Queen's Day, and the square was full of young people dressed very wildly, smoking marijuana, with gay men openly kissing in the street. The American minister had so many guards around her that they started jostling with the people in the crowd, very aggressive, and people were getting angry, so we just said, 'Forget it, let's go home,'" recalled Volkert. "That's what it's like these days when a visiting senior U.S. official tries to mingle with the locals. Forget it, let's go home." A friend of mine who has served several tours as a U.S. diplomat in Europe summed up this whole trend. "The upside is that we are more secure. The downside is you lose the human contact, and it makes it way harder to have interactions with people who are not part of the elite. It makes my job less fun. Some days you might as well be in Cleveland, looking at the world through a bulletproof plate glass window. Have no doubt, millions of foreigners would still line up for visas at American embassies even if we charged $1,000 per entry stamp and demanded their dental x-rays. But others, especially young Europeans, are thinking twice because they don't want the hassle, particularly the fact that they have to get fingerprinted. Roger Dow, president and CEO of the American Travel Industry Association, told me his organization estimated that by 2007, America had lost several million overseas visitors since 9/11, even though the dollar has steadily weakened, which means that America and everything in it is on sale to foreigners with euros or yen. Only the U.S. is losing traveler volume among major countries, which is unheard of in today's world, said Dow. Total business arrivals to the U.S. fell by 10% over the 2004-2005 period alone, while the number of business visitors to Europe grew by 8% over that same period, he said. The travel industry's 2007 Discover America Partnership Study concluded that the U.S. entry process has created a climate of fear and frustration that is turning away foreign business and leisure travelers from visiting the United States and damaging America's image abroad. Of course, there is a need for improved airport screening devices and safer embassies. We do have real enemies. 9/11 really was a diabolical and terrifying attack on New York City and our nation's capital. It really took the simmering global struggle between the West and Islamist totalitarians to a whole new level. And new threats are still appearing. We have to respond. Have we overdone it? Probably. I will never get used to watching grandmothers in wheelchairs being examined with metal detectors. But it is not the level of security that's the core issue for me. My problem is not with the metal detectors and screenings. My problem is that there's been nothing waiting on the other side. There has been way too little vision for an America of 9/12 and way too much 9/11, over and over and over. I would go through a gauntlet of 5 airport metal detectors every time I flew out of Washington, D.C., if I thought that there was some great project worthy of America on the other side, not just the war on terrorism. Even in the Cold War, when we were doing nuclear drills in my school basement, we were also figuring out how to launch men into space, probing the next frontier and inspiring a young generation. We need America, and the world needs America, to be something more than just the United States of fighting terrorism. Yes, we must never forget who our enemies are, but we must always remember who we are. They are the people who perpetrate 9/11s. We are the people who celebrate the 4th of July. That's our national holiday, not 9/11. We have so much more to win than just the war on terror. We have so much more to contribute. But changes in our politics and temperament over the last 3 decades, not only after 9/11, have fractured our focus and privatized our will. As a country, we seem to think less about the national interest, the public space, and the longer term. We'll get to it when we get to it, is still the order of the day. I can think of no better example of America's lack of sustained focus to take on a big challenge than the way we have dealt with our energy crises. In the wake of the 1973-74 Arab oil embargo, the Europeans and the Japanese responded by raising gasoline taxes, and, in Japan's case particularly, by launching a huge drive toward energy efficiency. France invested especially heavily in nuclear energy as a state project, with the result that today France gets 78% of its electricity from nuclear plants and much of the waste is reprocessed and turned into energy again. Even Brazil, a developing country, launched a national program to produce ethanol from sugarcane to make itself less dependent on imported oil. Today, between Brazil's domestic oil production and its ethanol industry, it doesn't need to import crude oil. America's initial response was significant. Urged on by Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, the United States implemented higher fuel economy standards for American cars and trucks. In 1975, Congress passed the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, which established corporate average fuel economy, CAFE, standards that required the gradual doubling of passenger vehicle efficiency for new cars to 27.5 miles per gallon within 10 years. Not surprisingly, it all worked. Between 1975 and 1985, American passenger vehicle mileage went from around 13.5 miles per gallon to 27.5, while light truck mileage increased from 11.6 miles per gallon to 19.5, all of which helped to create a global oil glut from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s, which not only weakened OPEC, but also helped to unravel the Soviet Union, then the world's second-largest oil producer. So, what happened next? Did we keep our focus on the long term? No. After the original congressional mandate of 27.5 miles per gallon took full effect in 1985, President Reagan, rather than continuing to increase the fuel economy standard to keep reducing our dependence on foreign oil, actually rolled it back to 26 miles per gallon in 1986. Reagan also slashed the budgets of most of President Carter's alternative energy programs, particularly the Solar Energy Research Institute and its four regional centers, which were just getting off the ground. Reagan's White House and the Democratic Congress also teamed up to let the tax incentives for solar and wind startups lapse, and several of these companies and their technologies, which were originally funded by American taxpayers, ended up being bought by Japanese and European firms, helping to propel those countries' renewable industries. Reagan even stripped off the solar panels Carter had put on the White House roof. They were eventually given away to a college in Maine, which later sold them in an online auction to history buffs. The Associated Press story, October 28, 2004, about that auction recalled, "The 32 panels were put on the presidential mansion during a period when the country was reeling from the effects of an Arab oil embargo. After calling for a nationwide campaign to conserve energy, President Jimmy Carter ordered the panels erected in 1979 to set an example for the country, according to the White House Historical Association. The solar heating panels were installed on the roof of the West Wing, but removed during Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1986, after the energy crisis and worries about dependence on foreign oil had subsided." In backing away from fuel economy standards, Reagan apparently thought he was giving America's then sagging domestic oil and auto industries a boost. The result? We quickly started to get re-addicted to imported oil. While the Reagan administration was instrumental in bringing down the Soviet Union, it was also instrumental in building our current dependence on Saudi Arabia. The Reagan administration was an environmental turning point, too. We forget, because it was so long ago, that there was a time when Washington had a bipartisan approach to the environment. It was a Republican, Richard Nixon, who signed into law the first wave of major environmental legislation in the United States, which addressed our first generation of environmental problems: air pollution, water pollution, and toxic waste. But Reagan changed that. Reagan ran not only against government in general, but against environmental regulation in particular. He and his Interior Secretary, James Watt, turned environmental regulation into a much more partisan and polarizing issue than it had ever been before. It has been so ever since. One noteworthy exception? It was Secretary of State George P. Shultz's team that enthusiastically negotiated the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer, a landmark international agreement designed to protect the stratospheric ozone layer that shields the planet from damaging UVB radiation. In 1989, the elder Bush's administration at least moved the fuel economy standard back up to the 1985 level of 27.5 miles per gallon. It also passed substantial improvements in building standards and new appliance standards, introduced a production tax credit for renewable energy, and elevated the Solar Energy Research Institute to the status of a national institution as the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. But as soon as Bush liberated Kuwait from Saddam Hussein and oil prices went back down, he did nothing strategic to liberate America from dependence on Middle East oil. When the Clinton administration came into office, it looked into raising fuel economy standards further, just for light trucks. But to make sure there would be none of that, Congress, spurred on by the Michigan Congressional Delegation, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Big Three automakers and the United Auto Workers, literally gagged and blindfolded the government when it came to improving mileage standards. Specifically, Congress inserted an appropriations rider into the fiscal year 1996 to fiscal year 2001 Department of Transportation Appropriations Bill that expressly prohibited the use of appropriated funds for any rulemaking by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to tighten fuel economy standards for American cars and trucks, thereby freezing the whole process. Congress effectively banned the NHTSA from taking any steps to improve mileage standards for American cars. This move blocked any mileage improvements until 2003, when the younger Bush's administration made a tiny adjustment upward in the mileage standard for light-duty trucks. In 2003, even China leaped ahead of the United States, announcing fuel economy standards for new cars, vans, and sport utility vehicles to get as much as 2 miles a gallon of fuel more in 2005 than the average required in the United States, and about 5 miles more in 2008. The New York Times, November 18, 2003. Only in late 2007, 32 years after Congress ordered mileage improved to 27.5 miles per gallon, did America once again act. It moved the U.S. fuel economy standard up to 35 miles per gallon, roughly where Europe and Japan are already, by 2020. That's 12 years away. One result of all this nonsense, according to a study by the Pew Foundation, was that in America, the average car and truck sold at the end of the 1990s went about a mile less on each gallon of gas than it did 10 years earlier. All this had a direct effect on our oil consumption and on our foreign policy. According to Amory Lovins, the experimental physicist who heads the Rocky Mountain Institute, if the United States had continued into the 1990s to conserve oil at the rate it did in the period from 1976 to 1985, thanks in large part to the improved mileage standards, it would no longer have needed Persian Gulf oil after 1985. When Reagan rolled back CAFE standards, said Lovins, it was the equivalent of undiscovering one Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's worth of oil. it wasted as much oil as is believed to exist under the refuge. Meanwhile, the 1979 accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power station ended any hopes of expanding our nuclear industry. Then Detroit introduced the sport utility vehicle and successfully lobbied the government to label these as light trucks so they would not have to meet the 27.5 miles per gallon standard for cars, but only the light truck standard of 20.7. So we became even more addicted to oil. When I asked Rick Wagoner, the chairman and CEO of General Motors, why his company didn't make more fuel-efficient cars, he gave me the standard answer: that GM has never succeeded in telling Americans what cars they should buy. "We build what the market wants," he said. "If people want SUVs and Hummers, you have to give them what they want." But what the Detroit executives never tell you is that one big reason the public wanted SUVs and Hummers all those years was that Detroit and the oil industry consistently lobbied Congress against raising gasoline taxes, which would have shaped public demand for something different. European governments imposed very high gasoline taxes and taxes on engine size and kept imposing them. And guess what? Europeans demanded smaller and smaller cars. America wouldn't impose more stringent gasoline and engine taxes, so American consumers kept wanting bigger and bigger cars. Big oil and big auto used their leverage in Washington to shape the market so people would ask for those cars that consumed the most oil and earned their companies the most profits. And our Congress never got in the way. It was bought off. These were the years the locust ate, brought to a filling station near you by a bipartisan alliance of special interests, with Democrats supporting the auto companies and their unions, and Republicans supporting the oil companies, while the groups representing the broad national interest were marginalized and derided as part of some eco-fringe. That is, dumb as we want to be. When the public is engaged, as it was after 1973, when people were waiting in lines for gasoline, it can override the entrenched interests of the auto and oil lobbies. But the minute, and I mean the minute, the public takes its eye off the ball, those special interest lobbyists barge back into the cloakrooms of Congress, passing out political donations and calling the shots according to their needs, not the nation's. What was good for General Motors was not always good for America. But few Democrats or Republicans in high office were ready to lead the country on a different energy path. Contrast this with how one small European country, Denmark, behaved after 1973. "We decided we had to become less dependent on oil," Connie Hedegaard, Denmark's Minister for Climate and Energy, explained to me. "We had a huge debate on nuclear, but in 1985, we decided against it. We decided to go instead for energy efficiency and renewable energy. We decided to use taxation, so energy was made relatively expensive, and therefore, people had an incentive to save and do things in their homes to make them more efficient. It was a result of political will." Premium gasoline in Denmark in 2008 was about $9 a gallon. On top of that, Denmark has a CO2 tax, which it put in place in the mid-1990s to promote efficiency, even though it had discovered offshore oil by then. When you get your electricity bill, you see your CO2 tax itemized, the minister said. "Surely all of this killed the Danish economy, right? Guess again. Since 1981, our economy has grown 70%, while our energy consumption has been kept almost flat all those years," she said. "Unemployment is a little less than 2%, and Denmark's early emphasis on solar and wind power which now provides 16% of its total energy consumption, spawned a whole new export industry. It has had a positive impact on job creation, said Hedegaard. For example, the wind industry. It was nothing in the 1970s. Today, one-third of all terrestrial wind turbines in the world come from Denmark. Industry woke up and saw that this is in our interest, to have the first mover advantage when we know the rest of the world will have to do this, will be to our benefit. Two of the world's most innovative manufacturers of enzymes for converting biomass to fuel, Danisco and Novozymes, also come from Denmark. In 1973, we got 99% of our energy from the Middle East, said Hedegaard. Today, it is zero. I know. Denmark's a small country, and it is a lot easier to make change there than across a huge economy like ours. Nevertheless, it's hard to look at Denmark and not see the road not taken. This sort of dumb as we want to be, we'll get around to it when we get around to it attitude was reinforced by our leaders' suspicion of the very government they were running. Reagan was the first modern president who actually ran against government. Reacting to the Vietnam War, the failure of the Great Society to end poverty, the cynicism of Watergate, and the hyperinflation and geopolitical fecklessness of the Jimmy Carter years, he argued that excessive government regulation and taxes threatened the American way of life, and that the country's economic prowess needed to be unshackled. There was a lot about Reagan's economic policy that made sense when it was first introduced. We did need to unlock talent, energy, and entrepreneurship that had been bottled up in our economy. But like all good things in politics, for everything there is a season and limits. Reaganism, which coincided with the collapse of America's mortal enemy, the Soviet Union, ushered in a period of history in which more and more public officials denigrated government and offered painless bromides for prosperity. The market was always right. Government was always wrong. And any policy proposal that involved asking the American people to do something difficult, to save more, drive more fuel-efficient cars, study harder, or be better parents, was off the table. You could not utter such phrases, so they claimed, and expect to be elected to any high office in America. Our parents' generation had to be the greatest generation, because the threats they faced were real, overwhelming, immediate, and inescapable. The Great Depression, the Nazis, and the nuclear-armed Soviet communists, said the Johns Hopkins foreign policy expert Michael Mandelbaum. That generation was ready to fight the Korean War and mobilize for the Cold War, precisely because it had been through the Depression and World War II. That generation understood how bad things could get. Robert Hormats, the vice chair of Goldman Sachs International, notes in his book The Price of Liberty, about how America has paid for its wars since 1776, that George Washington, in his farewell address, warned against ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden which we ourselves ought to bear. But that is exactly what we have been doing, and the cracks are starting to show. I was particularly troubled by the sudden collapse of the bridge on Interstate 35W in my home state of Minnesota, because it was a bridge I'd crossed hundreds of times in my youth. But that was not the half of it. In March 2008, my wife and I flew from New York's JFK Airport to Singapore. In JFK's departure lounge, we could barely find a place to sit. 18 hours later, we landed at Singapore's expansive, ultra-modern airport with free internet portals and children's play zones scattered throughout. We felt like we had just flown from the Flintstones to the Jetsons. If all Americans could compare Berlin's luxurious central train station today With the grimy, overcrowded Penn Station in New York City, they would swear we were the ones who lost World War II. It now appears in retrospect that the Cold War, while it had many downsides, had one big upside. It kept us focused as a country. It was a disciplining mechanism. We knew we could not be as dumb as we wanted to be when facing the Soviet Union. But with the disappearance of that seemingly overwhelming red menace, we have not had much competition lately, and it has made us complacent and lazy, said Fareed Zakaria, author of The Post-American World. Except the private sector, he added. American multinationals have to compete globally, and they do know how. The big multinationals get this new world. They live or die by it. The danger is not that America will collapse into a depression tomorrow. The strong and competitive sectors of our economy are as strong and competitive as any in the world. The danger is that the paralysis of the American political system, its inability to tackle any big multi-generational problem anymore, will just very slowly erode our strengths and assets as a society. We will slowly choke off immigration, slowly give up our commitment to free trade, slowly allow the budgets for research in science to decline, slowly let our public schools slide into mediocrity, and only slowly face up to our energy challenge. The danger, said Zakaria, is that it will be just slow enough so that we can be complacent and in denial about it. Things will just go along and go along until they don't anymore, until we wake up one day and look around and find that, as a country, we really have fallen behind. My friend Rob Watson, the environmental consultant, likes to say, you know, if you jump off the top floor of an 80-story building, you can actually feel like you're flying for 79 stories. It's the sudden stop at the end that gets you. If we don't wake up, that's where we're heading, toward a sudden stop at the end. That is the scenario we desperately need to avoid. It isn't inevitable, but avoiding it is no longer inevitable. Every day it feels to me more and more like we are living off the surpluses and infrastructure that were left to us by the greatest generation, without sufficiently replenishing them. While our parents left us an America much wealthier and healthier than the one that was passed on to them, our generation seems determined to pass on to our children a downwardly mobile America. George W. Bush came into office bound and determined not to ask the American people to do anything hard when it came to energy. On May 7, 2001, then White House spokesman Ari Fleischer was asked the following question at the daily press briefing. Does the president believe that, given the amount of energy Americans consume per capita, how much it exceeds any other citizens in any other country in the world, does the president believe we need to correct our lifestyles to address the energy problem? Fleischer responded, "That's a big no. The president believes that it's an American way of life, and that it should be the goal of policymakers to protect the American way of life. The American way of life is a blessed one." Fleischer went on to add that, of course, the president encourages energy efficiency and conservation, but he reiterated that the president believes the American people's use of energy is a reflection of the strength of our economy, of the way of life the American people have come to enjoy. And that was not going to change. After 9/11, I and others argued that we needed to institute a $1 per gallon gasoline tax, a patriot tax, in order to weaken the very forces who perpetrated that mass murder and to rebuild America's transport and energy infrastructure. It would have been George W. Bush's equivalent of Richard Nixon's going to China, the Texas oil man weaning America off its dependence on Middle East oil. that would have been transformational. He would have had an easy majority in the Congress. The country surely would have rallied. The price of gasoline would have gone up at the pump, but that would have stimulated